So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
You think of an event so gigantic that it changes the course of history. You think of a dawning of a new era. In this case, the dawning of a new era in the WWF. What was once a captivating, trend-setting program has now deteriorated into a cliched, let's be honest, boring snooze fest that is in dire need of a knight in shining armor.
Well, he's talking about you
and
now,
that's
JR.
Why I'm here. Chris Jericho has come to save the WWF.
You know what's funny? I wrote that promo by myself the night before in my room, and I never rehearsed it. I never went over it with anybody. I just went out there and did it, that promo that we just heard. That's how it was back then. There was no script writers. Yeah. Now you'd have to rehearse that a million times. Someone would write it for you. I wrote that whole thing, and no one had a clue what I was going to say until I walked through the curtain and started talking.
We got stars directing our fate, and we pray and it's not too late, because we know we're falling from grace, millennium.
Welcome to Review Away. I am John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting.
This is what they call the penultimate edition of Review Away before our anniversary special next week.
Oh, okay. Penultimate. Nice. Cool. Penultimate.
Big show next week. But big show this week.
Yeah. That's right.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah. You think so? It's like, it's only six. Six is not even a round number. I mean, actually it is, sorry. Wait, is it?
No,
it's not.
Six?
I'm thinking,
oh my god, this show.
I'm really bad at math. But it's six. It's like, come on. Five, ten.
I feel once you're at six, 15, it's like, okay, we get it.
Yeah, who cares? Sixth anniversary.
Like, one is, holy shit, they made it to one. Two is like, wow. Two. Six. Even three is like, okay.
No.
Five, big.
No.
Six, it's like.
Six is an insignificant number. So let's not even do a show next week.
Man. We can have Chris Jericho explain the significance of six. Because six days from now, it'll be you and me six. You know, we could have been sitting here about to review Halloween Havoc 1996, but I very much enjoyed going back and watching this show instead.
Me too.
I mean, the Attitude Era was certainly something that, you know, books have been written on, people have looked back on as it's just the greatest thing of all time. But then you actually go back, and it's like, it's like that where you'd go away for summer camp, and you'd go every summer throughout your childhood, and it was the most fun time of your life.
I've never been to summer camp, so I've not.
Play with the game.
Doesn't work with
just
me.
Roll with it. Okay. Something nostalgic, and as you're an older man, you think, wow, those are the days back at Scarborough summer camp, and then you go back, and you realize this place sucked. What a horrible looking area that my parents sent me to, and they paid for me to go here. And why are these men wearing bras? And I mean, just such weird stuff going on. Okay, you clearly missed something significant on this show.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about summer camp. I'm like, what type of camp did you go to?
The Attitude Era camp.
Men wore bras. What the fuck?
So you never went to summer camp?
No, never.
I have a wrestling tie-in to me going to summer camp.
Let's hear it.
for a number of summers. My parents were always like, you're going to summer camp this year.
Yeah, I don't know.
And it was a chore. It was like, I am not going. I don't want to go to those stupid summer camp.
Where was your summer camp?
It was north of the city. This wasn't even like overnight camp. It was just to go for 2 weeks during the day. You'd have to get onto a bus and go out to this farm that was a camp. And I'd go there all day. It's like going to school, but it's like fun activities for the whole day.
Oh, so you wouldn't stay there?
It wasn't an overnight camp.
Oh, okay.
But we went to an open house 1 year.
Yeah.
And me and my brother, we always refused. We're like, we're not going to summer camp. It's dumb. It's a summer. I don't want to go away to summer camp. So then my dad said,
you're going to jail, basically.
It's kind of.
Bus to jail.
It's like, you know, you're not doing road work, but at the same time, it's, you know, you're under someone's supervision. You're on their schedule.
You're forced to fold gimp.
Yes. I hated that shit.
I kind of like the
gimp.
I actually did go to summer camp.
That year. You're such a dick.
Not that I recall. Yeah.
You said that to fuck with my story.
No, I didn't. Anyway, continue, please.
So my dad tells me, he's like, John, if you go to summer camp this year, remember, I'm like 11 or 12. I'd say 11 years old at this time.
Yeah.
He says, I'm going to buy you WWF tickets when they come in the fall.
Damn, wow.
And right there on the spot, I said, I will come then to summer camp if you will buy me wrestling tickets.
Wow.
So I went to summer camp for 2 weeks, and the WWF came to town, and the WWF left town, and I did not go to that WWF show.
What the fuck?
My dad didn't give me tickets.
Your dad just straight up lied to you?
I guess.
Did you demand it afterwards? Hey, where were my tickets? You didn't ask?
I can't remember but we never went.
You probably just had such a great time at camp, you thought.
Well, I had to go 2 summers in a row to this place, and it was just the worst. It was just like, what a idea. I didn't have a fun time going to summer camp.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
why
did we even talk about
it? Because years after this...
You're comparing...
Instead of going to summer camp, here we were watching Raw on a Monday night.
Yeah. You're trying to make a point about how...
Oh, you want to tie this in even more. When this Raw took place, it was the night before a independent wrestling show here in Toronto at Medieval Times. Oh. Like 2 minutes from here.
Cool.
And this was at the peak of Jaws.
John's audio wrestling show.
Yes, with my buddy.
Which we won't be reviewing for the 6th anniversary.
No, we won't be reviewing it for that. Maybe if we make it to 26. Maybe we'll bust out a cassette tape.
Perhaps.
But I was, you know, furiously just trying to get interviews. And I remember at the time, you know, here I was 15 years old. And I was like, I wonder if I could get an interview with somebody for my little GeoCities-backed wrestling audio show.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, actually, it was Jeff Merrick of The Law who I messaged on ICQ. And I was like, hey, I'm really trying to get guests. How could I get someone in the WWF? And he came back and he sent me the fucking number for, like, the WWF's Canadian head office.
That's amazing.
So I called up and they put me through to somebody. And I'm, like, actually talking to someone. And it was, like, it was right around this time. This was like a house show. This was the house show at Skydome when Edge won the Intercontinental title. So a few weeks before that. And I said, I know the WWF is going to be in town in a few weeks. I would just like to get 10 minutes with anybody. And I'm pretty sure I said, listen, I know I can't get Steve Austin or Mankind. I would be happy with DOA. As if to say, I know these are the fucking schlubs that no one would want to talk to. Little did I know their hidden tattoos at the time, which I would not have known about. But nonetheless, I never got an interview with the WWF. Shockingly,
did they respond at least?
This I talked to someone on the phone.
Oh, okay.
Like this was not like an email or anything, and they said they would take my information and they would keep me on file. I was like, all right. I never heard back from them.
Oh.
But then there was this independent show happening, and it was happening. I remember it was a Tuesday show in Toronto, and I emailed the promoter, and I said, I very much would just like to speak to any wrestlers that were coming to this thing.
Yeah.
And I would be happy to do anything in return. And they were like, would you like to be on the ring crew? I said, fuck yeah, I'd love to be on the ring crew. So I came down to Medieval Times on that Tuesday morning at like 8 a.m. and I worked at that place the entire fucking day. And they said, if you can just help us set up and do whatever we need you to do, you know, just like, just tedious, tedious shit. It's like, you can have your access to all the talent we have here. And I mean, like, Tatanka was there, Too Cold Scorpio was there. And then one particular wrestler who I went up to talk to, and he said, I wanted to get his autograph. And maybe this is what turned me off of autographs, because he came back and he said...
Before or after the interview?
He wouldn't do an interview with
me. Oh, you just wanted the autograph. Okay.
So I asked him for this autograph. Here I am. I'm 15 at the time. And he's just like, catch me later. Catch me later. I was like, okay, I'll catch you later. And then I came back and he wanted like $10 for the autograph. And I said, no way. For a signature? And I left.
That's pretty typical.
Yeah. But he's had a very bad week, this particular week.
Who could it be? Wow, it's a lot of people. But I think I know who you're talking about.
But anyway, that was my first independent wrestling show. Actually, the best story was going up to one guy. And I got a bunch of... I chatted with a few people. I think Scott D'Amore was at that show. That would have been the first time I met Scott D'Amore. And I go up to this one guy who no one would have ever heard of. And I say, hey, man, could I just get like 5 minutes with you for my show? And he's like, yeah, 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 for sure, man. What's the name of it? I said, it's called The Jaws, John's Audio Wrestling Show. You know what his response was? Man, I'm just talking with some people here, man. I can't do it right now. I never forgot this guy ever. I was like,
who was it? Adam, come on.
You wouldn't have even, or I can't even fully remember the name, so I don't want to guess at what his name was. Like, complete, like, you never would have heard of this guy.
Oh, but, that's so great.
Yeah, it was quite the show.
That's very, that's a great story.
It was a Medieval Times. It was a very fun venue to watch wrestling. Have you ever been to Medieval Times?
Yeah, not for wrestling, but it's...
Picture, like, a ring in the middle of that, like, pit where
that's
they...
perfect.
Yeah, and like the seats are, it's great. It was great. And they never went back there. And I remember the promoter telling me, he was like, you can work for all of our shows and keep it between us. But around Christmas time, we're going to be running Maple Leaf Gardens and we're going to have Bret Hart on our show. And even me at 15, that was my first bullshit moment, because I'm like, dude's under contract at WCW. You are not running Maple Leaf Gardens.
Yeah.
And, they did not run Maple Leaf Gardens, nor did Bret Hart ever appear for that promotion.
Oh, man.
But there you go.
So that was right around the time of...
Sorry, the tie-in is this was the day after this Raw.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And Raw, if you recall, it aired at like midnight at this point most weeks. Mm-hmm. It wasn't always on at 9 p.m. It would often get moved just to midnight or something if a game was on TSN or something mm-hmm. like that. So I think I watched this like early Tuesday morning at like 6 a.m. and then I went to... this Medieval Times deal for the entire day.
That was just, wow. That, like, this has been your life for a long time now. Half your life.
Do you remember what you were doing on August 9th of 1999? It was the summer.
Maybe getting ready to go to summer camp.
Wouldn't it have been funny if you had attended this show?
Why?
We both would have been
the Medieval Times show?
Yeah.
No, I didn't start going to live wrestling until maybe like 2001.
Well, did you watch, were you watching Raw at the time? Typically, your viewing periods are in dark contrast to when they were very popular. So they were extremely popular in the summer of 99. So I imagine this was not your cup of tea.
I probably wasn't watching that closely. Although, being in high school at this time during the Attitude Era, I think you can't really help but be aware of exactly what was going on, because everybody in school was talking about, hey, did you see this on Raw last night? People were like doing wrestling moves to each other. It was very embarrassing.
Yeah. I mean, were your friends around you, like, were they big wrestling fans?
Yeah.
And you didn't watch?
Nope.
Like, you would think that would be the catalyst, that you would have a incentive to watch when all your friends were into it. See, I was the opposite in high school. Like, dude, I had no friends that watched wrestling. I had one buddy of mine who was like into wrestling. And the guy who I did my Jaws show with, man, when school started at the end of that, the summer of 99, man, him and I, we like he was the one who came up with this idea for the show, because he was like a computer genius at the time when I had just gotten the internet. I knew nothing. And he was like, dude, we should do a show. And I was like, okay, you know nothing about wrestling, but we could do a show for sure. I lent him some tapes and was like, watch these and you'll know everything. That was my teachings of this guy. It's like, I gave him like 5 tapes. I'm like, watch this. You'll know all the main guys. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, yeah, we should totally do a show. I'll take care of all of it. I'm like, okay, cool. Bought a shitty microphone. All summer we did this show. School started that year. Dude wanted nothing to do with pro wrestling. He was done.
He was over it.
He was done with wrestling. And
what's he doing now?
I have no idea. Huh. It was so weird. It was like we were the best of friends for like 2 years. And then summer ended that year. And we just drifted apart. And we like just moved on.
Mm.
Weren't friends after. Like just, you know, we'd see each other at school, but never hung out.
Very sad story. That can't happen.
Yeah. So I had no one in high school to chat about wrestling with.
Mm. Yeah, no, it was never really like that for me. But I think I always kind of, I was always aware of what was going on. I would always peek in here and there, but I would never watch, like, hardcore, you know. I wouldn't necessarily go online, read news.
You weren't taking notes as you watched wrestling shows, nope. And we're going to be dedicating so many hours a week and working at a network.
Perhaps I had an inkling that somewhere in my future I would have to rewatch these shows anyway. So I didn't do it then.
I wonder if you could go back in time, like a choose-your-own-adventure novel. And that day at Ryerson,
yeah,
when you asked me, hey, you're John Pollock? I wonder if you could go back. I mean, what a difference your life would have been if you had just chosen. And sometimes I wonder if you wish you never piped up.
No.
Where
absolutely.
Would my life have gone? Maybe you would be, who knows?
I don't know.
Could have been a completely different way.
I have no idea.
It's like, fuck. Why did I run into John Pollock on that fucking day? I was going so well in life. And now here I am.
Maybe you would ask yourself the same question if
I didn't meet myself?
If you had not decided to work in that medieval times ring crew that day.
No. The key decision for me that altered my career path was Jason Agnew calling me saying, hey, we need a call screener. Do you want to do this? And I seriously contemplated it. I was like,
how did you get your number?
Well, we knew each other. We were already friends before I started working.
Oh, because you're a fan of the show.
Yeah. I mean, I went to O'Grady's. Yeah. I'd met them a lot. So this was 2003 when I started at the Law.
Yeah.
I probably met them, years before that. I met them at the WCW pay-per-view that was here in Toronto. That's when I first met Mouth and Agnew. But anyway, when I took that call screener, spot, because I was the person that hosted all the pay-per-view parties on Sunday nights with all my friends. They would all come over every Sunday once a month for the pay-per-views. I'm like, if I stop this, I know they'll stop, because I knew they were like clinging to a thread.
Yeah.
So I had to make a key decision, and I made it.
Oh.
Had I not taken that call screener spot, I would not have started with the Law, duh, and I wouldn't have ever started with the Fight Network.
Mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't have got into the Fight Network any other way.
Oh.
I probably wouldn't have even been aware of the Fight Network.
I doubt that.
Why? Why would they have hired me?
I feel like you could... I mean, I wasn't involved at that time, and I got in eventually. I mean, through the internships. I feel like you would have probably made...
We could have both been intern editors.
Yeah, I feel like you would have made your way in eventually.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe I would be
maybe
doing...
You would have
maybe I would be doing all of this, but for golf.
Yeah, or the World Fishing Network.
Because I would have had all this free time that I wouldn't have been spent watching wrestling.
Yeah.
I probably would have trailed out of it, to be honest, throughout university. I'm almost certain I would have.
Yeah. It happens, I think, to many people.
I very much think that 2003, I was watching UFC regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think as Ultimate Fighter hit, I think I very much would have gone the path of most people, and I would have gotten into MMA.
Yep.
And who knows? What a fascinating... Maybe that should be our anniversary show. We play a whole game of what if.
Mm, yeah.
Could make a choose your own adventure where you could make all these key decisions and see where you end up.
That's a little deep.
We could have like an expert come in of like brain activity, and if you had decided to do this, your brain path would have led you here based on your characteristics. And we would have found out that I would have been doing golf podcasts and Wei would be shooting porn maybe.
That could still be in my future. Who knows?
Never close any doors.
Never.
Keep them all open.
Nope.
Because if someone said that to a pro wrestler, he might not have become governor of Minnesota.
Ah.
Never close doors.
Tying it back in.
So that will take us into our review of Raw is War. This was back when Raw was War.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pre-9/11 naming of WWE Raw. From Chicago, Illinois, at the, I don't know if they were calling this the Allstate Arena or the Rosemont Horizon at the time. Same damn thing. Very old arena. And it was the immediate start of the show was the display of the Millennium Clock counting down to the end of Nikki Bella's title reign. I couldn't believe people are going to think that we chose this show and it wasn't random when we chose this last week. It's like, oh, they chose this because of the Nikki Bellatron. No. Well,
I don't know how many people would think that. Really.
Because they would have heard this, our announcement of this review after the Bellatron had been introduced. However,
it's just such an, they're all such insignificant things that I don't think anybody.
How many times has there been a countdown clock in WWF history? Two. There's two of them.
Well, I mean,
and of all the weeks that we chose to do this show, they introduced that clock.
They did the Santino clock,
the Hunkometer, but that was counting up. This was a countdown clock.
All right,
it was the identical thing, and we had chosen this just like we recorded that show like 3 days before Nikki Bella introduced it. It was the craziest coincidence.
Fine.
Why can't you concede that's a coincidence?
It is a coincidence. I'm just saying how. If I was a fan of this show...
Wait, who did not think of the Millennium Clock when they saw Nikki Bella's thing?
Me.
Okay, well, you're one of the few. Because that's the only time they've done such a similar thing.
All right, let's move on.
Jeez. You're upset over this.
I'm not upset. I just... It's not worth spending time on.
Well, the Millennium Clock is what started off the show. Did you like this idea?
I loved it. Love this idea. I mean, I think it's such a unique way to bring to introduce a new character, and that graphic. It looks.
This was like 4 weeks of like just general intrigue over what this was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I did see bits and pieces of the show back then, and at the time, I just thought, oh, okay, they're just trying to like. It wasn't unusual, you know, back at that time, to just kind of. Jump on the hysteria of the new millennium.
Oh, yeah, there was genuine fear in this year of what was going to happen. Everything was going to explode.
So, I mean, I think just as a fan at the time, I didn't think it was anything leading up towards an introduction of a new wrestler. And I guess it wasn't until, you know, at the time I was on the internet and then you could still see reports of people saying that this was for the debut of Chris Jericho. Actually, in fact, on the law.
Jeff Merrick.
Yeah.
Because at this time... He was part of the off-the-record crew that went down to Stanford, and I remember this, where I think Jeff had, like, lunch with Vince McMahon, and they went over a bunch of stuff, and it was either the night before or the week before, and they're talking about the Millennium Clock, and it was just like, Jeff was like, yeah, they probably don't want it to be said, but yeah, it's Jericho.
That's right, yeah. I definitely probably heard it from American Law. So I love the idea. I love the visual representation of it. But the thing I love the most about this clock, and this extends to the Chris Jericho, Titantron for all those years, it was the sound, the buzz of that. I fucking love it. I want it as my alarm on my phone in the morning.
That's a great alarm to wake up to.
I just love that sound. It's oddly soothing.
I don't know soothing. If you had to listen to this for an hour, but you know what? You are an outlier because anyone that's ever driven in a car with Way when he's got his music on, he does find the weirdest shit soothing.
Yeah, this just sounds like it would sound like a cool song.
Remember one time I thought I'm like, dude, your thing's skipping. He's like, no, that's a song. This was also, it's not like the WWF was paranoid about this secret getting out to the point that, like, everyone knew Jericho had signed. WWF even announced it on their website. They had signed Jericho and put a video up of Chris Jericho in a car. And he randomly, like, sarcastically said, yes, I'm coming in and my name is going to be Excalibur. And all these idiots, they're like, Excalibur? Why are they going to call him Excalibur? It was like, it was so clearly a joke. But it was not like, this was on the WWE.
It doesn't sound that crazy to me.
Well,
today.
Okay. But it was just such a stupid name that I didn't give it even a second thought. But yeah, they put it on their website. I mean, they were not even hiding the fact that they had signed Chris Jericho. And I think that there was something to that, that today there's such a demand internally of we've got to, they can't even have a thread of seeing this coming. And surprises are fine. But you also want to tease what it could be so that when you finally deliver it, I mean, listen to this reaction when Jericho came out. Mm-hmm. Arguably the greatest debut the WWF has ever presented.
Yes.
And a lot of people knew he was coming. And mm-hmm. it was just that much more satisfying because Chris Jericho coming was a big deal to people. So that's great. We want to see that. And you do want to kind of throw out teases so that you still get the big reaction, but it's not so out of left field that no one's even aware of what's going to be happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a certain art to the surprise. Jim Ross notes the sellout and the incredible atmosphere here in Chicago. And The Rock comes out for his first of about 80 segments on this particular show and comes out wearing the grossest looking dress shirt you've ever seen. He looked like he had recovered this shirt from a house fire. It was this combination of like orange and maroon splashed together.
It looked like
just vomited all over this man's chest.
Yeah. It looked like a Magic Eye poster.
Holy Christ. He was attacked the night prior by The Big Show and The Undertaker on Sunday Night Heat. My God, was Sunday Night Heat the setup of like everything on this particular show?
Mm-hmm.
This is where guys went to attack one another to set up matches for Raw. And it was a tool they used quite a lot in 1999. And The Rock is out for this promo, and they cut to the gorilla position where The Undertaker and Big Show, who are a tag team at this time, are with Paul Bearer. And Taker tells Big Show, wait, let's see what he says. Like telegraphing the run-in by showing them getting set for the run-in.
Mm-hmm.
I like this.
It was interesting.
Yeah, it's just something different. Something that you never see where it's like, how do they come out so fast? How are they ready? It's like they're right there at the go position.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Ross says, The Rock has 13 days to get ready for badass Billy Gunn at SummerSlam in one of the dumber usages of The Rock. Like, think about that. One of your major pay-per-views at one of your peak years. And this guy was fighting the dude with poison ivy on his
ass. Didn't Billy Gunn win the King of the Ring that year?
He did. And boy, was he soaring to great depths post-King of the Ring with this particular run. The whole feud was literally about Billy Gunn's ass.
Yeah.
And then the following, the prior week on Raw, Billy Gunn showed this large man's ass insinuating it was The Rock's ass. And that was the build to SummerSlam that year for the number two match. Jesus Christ. So, Rock runs down Big Show, mocks his theme song, calls him the Big Slow. Crowd's chanting for him. They just go nuts for anything this guy does. Does the choke slam gesture.
So basically, Taker told Big Show to stay back. Let's see what he has to say.
Let's watch this. Yeah. And this was not enough to prompt Big Show at first. He wanted to hear him out. So then Taker, Big Show, and Paul Bearer come out. They double-team The Rock. X-Pac runs in for the save. They beat him down. Road Dogg comes out. They knock him down. And then finally Kane comes out, and they're finally able to stop the two big men. 4-on-2 as The Rock is just selling forever here. Big Show, this was also during a phase in his career when he was only wearing trunks. And this was also after, I mean, he was in pretty good shape per mm-hmm. Big Show standards here. Yeah. I mean, he had had, I don't know if it was liposuction or if it was just gastric. He had had that surgery, though, before coming to the WWF where you had seen, like, this guy was pretty leaned out for a guy that was the size of Paul White.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they cleared house here and big segment here. The crowd was, I mean, this was just kind of a cavalcade of characters that were all over at this particular time in 1999.
Definitely, especially Kane and X-Pac, those two. I mean, hard to think now, but X-Pac was just, a big-time babyface at this time.
They plugged Jesse Ventura appearing on the show tonight one day after meeting with President Clinton, to emphasize how old this show was, and previewed a bunch of matches for tonight's show. And then a limo arrives, and they all assume it's Jesse Ventura, but out comes Commissioner Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels, who was a very different personality in 1999 than he would be in years later. And, you know, I talk about including commercials. All the WWF inventory was left in this show, including our commercial for...
On the network.
On the network, yes. On StoneCold.com. Their own customized website for Steve Austin, where the background for this ad, it was just the WWF website.
Oh, is that right?
But this was at a point where they had bought the URLs for, like, all their main guys. Mm-hmm. So they had TheRock.com, they had StoneCold.com, and they had their little customized websites before the, I guess, the dot-com crash, where I guess these URLs were less valuable to them. And having individual websites.
Well, hit up StoneCold.com right now, so let's see what's up
there. I wonder where it would go.
It probably redirects. My guess.
Okay, StoneCold.com takes us to WWE.com. So there you go. Let's see TheRock.com if they still have that one. Those are the only two I can remember. Oh, there you go. So they still own them. They just redirect them to WWE.com. Mm. Good for them. What if they have WCW.com? Yeah, they've got all of it. And it takes you right to a photo of the Dungeon of Doom.
It's actually the WCW subsection.
Yeah, the subsection here. Look at this. Well.
Well, why don't you type in like something really random, like the Mean Street Posse, MeanStreetPosse.com.
I wonder if that will take us. If it's not wrestling, it'll be a... Oh, okay. Don't have that.
Oh, it's available, everybody.
How about VinceMcMahon.com? Okay. You would think VinceMcMahon.com would be owned. No, VinceMcMahon.com is available.
Oh, oh my God.
Steal that. Wow. Oh, there you go.
Are dot-coms really that valuable? I mean, they are, yes. But
do you want to...
People just Google shit now.
JohnPollock.com. I guarantee you, it's this kid, this family, and they've just got their baby's picture on it.
Oh, you've
I've not, looked at
it's
it before.
Not even loading.
I considered buying... Oh, maybe it's not. If this is available, I'm going to buy it.
Okay. Right now?
I might.
Okay. Do it.
No, it's just loading.
All right. This is bad radio.
Okay. Young Michael Cole is in the back with X-Pac and Kane. X-Pac is over his concussion, he announces. He's remedied himself.
Mm-hmm.
And his response is over his concussion and being healed. You're goddamn right! And goddamn was his trademark phrase here, apparently. They want a tag title match against the Acolytes. And X-Pac proclaims that you don't have a goddamn thing to say about it. They just booked themselves into a title match. It's that easy.
Yeah, X-Pac, man. he cuts a very intense... he's intense, let's
not,
just say.
He's one of the more underrated screaming promos, I would say.
Yeah, right. I don't know. He was obviously very popular at this time. But I don't think you could ever say that he was a smooth promo, you know?
Oh, no.
He's a guy who just came out and would just kind of, like, scream. Like,
he's got that very, in years past, I mean, even more so today, but that very raspy voice as well.
Yeah. But very rough.
Rough, yes. Yeah. But, though, later we'll discuss dueling promo skills between him and his tag partner.
Oh, yes.
To kick off the show, we had Christian against Gangrel. The Brood had separated at this point with Gangrel turning on the group. But here in the breakup, Gangrel got the theme music and the entrance.
Well, it was his to begin with.
I guess so, but who had more upside here? The Edge and Christian duo or Gangrel?
It was more of a vampire entrance.
I guess so, and I guess maybe they wanted... But they weren't necessarily breaking Christian and Edge off from that. I mean, you still had Christian wearing that goofy shirt during this match, so they still had the gothic kind of look to them. Yeah, Christian just came out to this terrible theme music. Gangrel just charges at him at the start. Christian goes for a dropkick that does not come close to connecting with Gangrel, who just sold it anyway and rolled to the floor. Christian came off the apron into the barricade. And then we had 5 seconds where the cameraman was behind Tim White, and we had to watch the action through his legs.
Yeah, it's a rare little fumble.
And there's a tornado DDT by Christian. Then he goes for his impaler, the unprettier. This was back when it was pretty, I guess.
Yeah, It's weird because they would call the Impaler Gangrel's finisher.
Yeah, they had the Impaler DDT, and then Christian's was the Impaler. Not as creative.
They're all impalers. Well,
they're trying to impale them. But then the Hardy show up on the apron, and man, this really showed you the mindset of Jeff Hardy at this point. Christian just like knocks Jeff, who does this crazy flip off the apron to the floor that the camera barely catches. And man, Jeff was just selling everything as if it was just, I mean, doing way too much than he needed to at this point during the limited time he was on TV. And then Christian attacks both members of the Hardys. Christian then comes off the top, and Gangrel hits him with the red mist and then the Impaler DDT for the win in 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Then the Hardys run in. They're attacking Christian. Edge comes in for the save and spears Matt, but then Christian attacks Edge from behind with the Impaler DDT. And they triple team Edge and then Christian, who are laid out, and who should run down? I had totally forgotten about this, but at this point we had had Gangrel, who was with the Brood, and then they broke up, and the Hardys had attached themselves to Michael P.S. Hayes, who, as their mentor, also would dress like the Hardys.
Yes.
So Michael Hayes comes out with this tight orange shirt and green cargo pants. This was worth the viewing of this entire Raw alone. But then the Hardys turn on Michael Hayes, and they hit him with a Twist of Fate and the Safest Swanton. And this was, I guess, the write-off of Michael Hayes and inserting Gangrel as the new leader of the Hardys, who would go through this phase as the new Brood. And it didn't work for them. And it wasn't until after the ladder match that they kind of ditched the new Brood gimmick and got them away from Gangrel. But Gangrel, I thought, really served his purpose of a veteran working with Edge and Christian. They kind of tried to reinvent it with the Hardys. It didn't work as well. But this was essentially the kickoff to what would become that best of tournament that led to the big ladder match, the tit tournament. Yes.
Yes. It's a lot of fun to go back and watch these incarnations of Edge and Christian and the Hardys, because this was at a time when all four men were still very generic. They really didn't have any mic time. They didn't really have any personality to speak of when you watch them on TV. They're more so just kind of, you know, in the case of Edge and Christian, kind of playing spin-offs of the Gangrel character. And it's fun to go back and watch these guys. The match itself was just such a brief match. Neither man, I felt, were that over. The match itself didn't get much of a reaction. But, you know, didn't talk much. It was cool to see these four and to see Michael Hayes attached to the Hardys.
Yes,
brief time.
His fleeting run as the third member of the Hardys. Michael Cole is with the Acolyte to accept the title match with Kane and X-Pac, and they call X-Pac a Chihuahua. Then we had Chef Boyardee was the big title sponsor for SummerSlam, and they had created a commercial where it was a music video called Getting Chefy With It, starring The Rock on a massive boat eating Chef Boyardee with hot women.
Chefy,
you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Getting chefy with The Rock, he's hot. Got the best of everything to make a good time rock. Got a real fine ride with the chef inside. And we're getting chefy with it.
Rock playing the smackdown.
The Rock says, don't be a jabroni, eat your Chef Boyardee ravioli.
I think he's getting chefy with it.
Yeah.
I love 1999.
It was great.
What
yeah.
a year.
Getting chefy with it.
Getting chefy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jerry Lawler's in the ring to bring out Jesse Ventura, who received a lot of criticism for his involvement at this time. First of all, it's a sitting governor where Jesse Ventura had come out very negative on the WWF right after Owen Hart had died in May of 1999. So it was a big, you know, there was a lot of complaints when all of a sudden they announced Jesse Ventura's coming in to be our guest referee at SummerSlam and kind of shifting that focus. And now you had a lot of people, especially in Minnesota, who were upset that here's this guy who is our governor that is taking time off to go do pro wrestling. And he was establishing the fact he's working during the day. What he does on a Monday night or on a Sunday is up to him. Mm. But it was a big controversy at the time that here was this governor who is this in the best interest of his constituents that he's working for the World Wrestling Federation and has to travel to places like Chicago, and are there public funds that are going into this? And anyway, there was a lot of that going on at this particular time. So Jesse Ventura comes out, got a very good reaction here.
Oh yeah.
And
when was the last time Jesse was even in the WWE or WWF prior to this?
Oh, prior to this, yeah. You would have to go all the way back to his 1990 or yeah. so. So mm-hmm. He had sued the company after that. So, I mean, they had had a very nasty breakup where he was able to beat them in court to get the rights to his, because he was one of the guys that didn't sign over his likenesses. And that changed a lot because whenever they used Jesse Ventura, they had to pay him. So mm-hmm. when they put out their WrestleMania anthology sets, I mean, Jesse Ventura would always get a cut of his stuff because of that deal that he was able to get through himself. So anyway, once you become governor and an asset to a pay-per-view, all is forgiven. So he comes out. And he goes over his whole resume as a former champion. Notes he was the first guest referee at the inaugural SummerSlam that you and Dan Lavransky reviewed this past summer.
Right.
So tying it all together with mm-hmm. the very first SummerSlam. And then goes on this big speech about how he was a Navy SEAL and that there's a lot of frauds out there who claim to be SEALs and ran away when their country called to go play in a hippie rock band and have Bozo the Clown haircuts and star in made-for-TV movies, which I can only assume was a direct shot at Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Those two have had a lot of contentiousness over their years. And, I mean, WCW, when Ventura won to become governor, that's when Hogan came out and did his whole I'm running for president deal. And the two have always disliked one another, going way back to Jesse trying to start a union and believing that it was Hulk Hogan who was the one who stomped that. And anyway, that's what I took this to be. But I could see many people being lost here, what he was going off on.
Trying to think who else has those of the clown haircut.
It's pretty very select company in the wrestling fraternity. So anyway, after he got all that off his chest, he says he is the power in Minnesota, and he emphasizes that the best wrestler will leave with the championship at SummerSlam when Steve Austin takes on Triple H, and then proceeds to call Vince McMahon a scumbag, and that Vince McMahon is not here because of him, and ignoring the fact that Vince lost a stipulation match at the last month's pay-per-view to disappear from television. Then Triple H interrupts. He comes out in his lovely 1999 acid wash jeans alongside China back in happier times between the two. Do you want to describe Triple H's wardrobe of 1999? That backwards leather deal on his, what do you call those hats? Like everyone just, they're like the Kangol style hats.
Samuel L. Jackson hat.
Yeah, that's what it's become. The Samuel L. Jackson
hat.
Was he
wearing that here?
He was wearing a black leather one, yes.
Okay. I mean, that was sort of his pseudo-biker look.
Leather meant badass mm-hmm. in 1999. So Ventura tells him to go work on his wrestling moves for SummerSlam. And Hunter comes back calling Ventura a relic from the 70s. Hunter says this is his world and this is his ring. But Jesse says this is my country. And he met with President Clinton the other day. And Hunter says he's bigger than the president. And threatens to kick Ventura's ass when Shawn Michaels comes out. He says Ventura has standards and practices to abide by, but Shawn Michaels does not. And then says he is the most powerful man in World Wrestling Federation history.
Mm.
A flub from one Shawn Michaels here. And Michaels says he brought Hunter into this world. Through his genetics.
He's like the Jason Agnew to your... Or he's like your Jason Agnew.
I guess so, yes. And tells Hunter to get that glare out of your stare. and he shoves Hunter shoves Michaels. They tease having a fight, but Michaels says no, 3 years from now. And ends up getting talked out of it, and Michaels then announced that tonight there's going to be a three-way match involving Hunter, Steve Austin, and The Undertaker. Quite the impromptu main event for Raw on an hour's notice. And that's how the segment ends. And then we had an ad for SmackDown's debut coming up on August 26th. Prepare for impact when the most dangerous soap opera invades prime time. The most dangerous soap opera. What a hook.
That was sort of a buzz term at the time, right? Male soap opera.
Yeah, that was kind of the go-to description.
Yeah.
That a lot still used to this day. But
yeah.
Anyway, what did you think of this segment? And kind of, this was more teasing tension involving Jesse and Hunter for SummerSlam than anything involving Steve Austin or Hunter even going after the title.
Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, Jesse came out here and really felt like kind of a... He's somebody who now had, at this point, had a lot of mainstream cachet, but also somebody with a, obviously, you know, tremendous long history in pro wrestling, who just came out. He was a very popular guy, but was also able to completely fit into a pro wrestling delivery. And I thought here he fit very well with Triple H and Shawn Michaels. Really, if you look at the scene, it's three of the great talkers of the business. But in particular, I think at this point, I was probably most impressed with Triple H, who, you know, he hadn't won his title yet. Right?
No. He wouldn't. He would win it the night after SummerSlam.
Right. Okay. So still a guy very much, you know, primed for that main role. But the moment, like even here amongst Shawn Michaels, amongst Jesse Ventura, Triple H came out with just tremendous confidence and a real aura to him that you could tell, you know, he pretty much just stood toe to toe with this guy who just a day earlier was in the New York Times paper.
Do you think that's something that some of the guys today that struggle with that, like that aura to me is such an important, it's to maybe the most important thing in that position. And at this time in 1999, I mean, people were not sold on this guy. Mm-hmm. I don't feel it was really till the Foley program that people accepted him as this top guy. But yeah, you go back and watch this, and maybe it's hard to watch this knowing what Hunter has done post 1999, but you go back to this time, it's like, you know, he was a fresh guy on top, good talker, good in the ring. He had all the tools.
I simply compare, though, you know, Triple H's position in 1999 on a segment like this to somebody who is on Raw today in a similar position. And I mean, you can even look at a guy like Seth Rollins, who's already been champion for however many months. I still wouldn't put him at the level of Triple H at this point in 1999 without having won the title in terms of just a confidence. And that's obviously Seth Rollins has gotten really good, but I'd say Triple H still seemed more comfortable, more natural, more fitting of that main spot character at this point, even without the title.
My only criticism with this segment is that I really would have liked, had Stephanie been involved here, to inform Hunter that he's not half the man Shawn Michaels is. Even though there was no match coming up at SummerSlam involving Shawn and Hunter, and it wouldn't happen for a long, long time, I think to emphasize how little Hunter is in comparison to the fictional person, I think that would have really drilled home that this is our guy and kind of belittle him a bit. I think that could really... it could really grow into something and have the whole show based around Hunter's inferiority.
It's funny, though, how you mentioned that, because, I mean, there were times in this where Shawn Michaels kind of plays that role. Tells Hunter that I was the one who brought you in, I'm the one who taught you everything you know, et cetera, et cetera. But at no point did I necessarily get the feel that, you know, this guy was, like, legitimately inferior. Like, this Triple H character in 1999 didn't play much of a comedy goofball.
There was no comedy.
Like, unlike a Seth Rollins, you know, which we still often get today, where he you know, kind of is somebody who is duped on camera by Triple H, by Stephanie. You know, somebody who is easily manipulated by
No, he came out and he felt like the guy. He came out and... You know, promo ability, I mean, the guy was not to be confused with the great talkers of his era. But he came out and they put him and Jesse, I mean, they were Hunter was not subservient to Jesse Ventura. He stood up to him, and I think they it's weird. It's a different dynamic of babyface to heel, but it was the same thinking of Steve Austin with Mike Tyson that, you know, our guy is on this big celebrity's level, and we want to present our guys as being on this level. And typically the go-to dynamic now with celebrities is that the WWE guys are beneath these people, or that they are the ones that are kind of booked to be the stronger of the two. But they were the whole summer of 1999, it was developing Triple H to be a top heel. And the following year, I mean, a year after this, I mean, there was no dispute that Hunter was arguably the top guy in the business at that point. Anyway, D'Lo Brown, they are shown earlier in today. He is out in the woods training Mark Henry to lose weight. And Henry has to go to the bathroom in the woods. And shockingly, he was not the one that would get poison ivy on his ass, despite going into the woods. And as D'Lo is awaiting him to come back from his urination, a car pulls up, and who comes out but Jeff Jarrett, who I guess has been tailing them all day long, and attacks D'Lo by throwing him into a tree. Not a bump you get too often in pro wrestling, a guy being thrown into a tree, and then hit with a large garbage can as Debra is shouting from the car and takes off. Nothing screams SummerSlam title match than an attack in the park.
Yeah, it was weird. It was kind of creepy. Like, you know, these two black men are running in the woods, and then this southern white man just drives by, gets out of his car, and starts attacking these men, and then drives away.
God,
it was weird.
Citing a race war here. It was the 1999 creative staff.
Kind of uncomfortable.
Okay, so then Jeff comes out with Debra. And Debra's whole gimmick at this point was, this poor woman just wants to show her tits to the crowd, and no one will allow her to do this. And the announcers had to be, like, sympathetic to her plight.
That was, like, every female manager's gimmick in the WWE at this time.
Kelly would become the exhibitionist.
Sable.
Yeah, it's like these poor women just want to show their tits.
Yeah.
So then we had this cutaway that this was the cutaway of all cutaways, and I had to pause this as we had five men in the balcony of the Allstate Arena, all wearing bras, with a sign that read, they had two signs. One dude had a sign that read, "I want to do the puppies doggy style. Divas Revolution."
I don't know how that'd be even physically possible.
But then the other group had this large sign, and this was the quote verbatim. "Hey, Debra, show us yours, baby, and we will you ours." "Hey, Debra, show us yours, baby, and we will you ours.
We will you ours." Okay.
This
let me pull
this up. Only confirmed the intelligence level of these five. This was one of the most frightening images of these five dudes wearing bras in the balcony of the Allstate Arena.
Yeah, this is more uncomfortable than the previous scene.
We're going to get some, like, fact checks. Like, actually, that was CM Punk and his friends.
Let me look at... "Hey, Debra, show us yours, baby, and we will you ours." These idiots.
This is the low point or highlight of the show, depending on your perspective.
I wonder what these men are doing now.
Oh, God, probably...
maybe running for governor somewhere.
Who knows? Maybe. I wonder if they're still fans. They seem like fair weather fans.
Yeah.
So then Debra goes to take her jacket off, and Jeff, of course, stops her. So we got Jeff Jarrett against Val Venus. Jarrett cost Venus the Intercontinental title, who it happened on Sunday Night Heat the night before with D'Lo defending the IC title. D'Lo was both the IC and European champion at the time, and he'd be defending both titles against Jarrett at SummerSlam. We had a sign from a woman in the crowd that read, "I'd rather be on Venus." And then Jarrett attacks Val as he goes to do his opening speech. Ross says something has happened backstage, but cannot state what. There's a big puppies chant. Side Russian leg sweep by Venus. Debra gets on the apron, and it leads to Val hitting a blue thunder bomb onto Jarrett, who pins him in a minute 25. Jarrett, mind you, would be the one challenging for two titles at SummerSlam in 13 days.
Mm. Yeah. Well,
this was a typical 1999 Raw match, minute 25.
Mm-hmm.
So Jarrett gets upset with Deborah. Venus returns and attacks Jarrett. And then, this was so funny. You probably didn't catch this. But Jarrett is upset, and they cut to him leaving on the ramp yelling at Deborah, but they cut to him mid-sentence, and all you hear is, "Come in the damn ring!" Which is what Jarrett yells.
Oh.
Which, being that it was Val Venus, made it comedic. Come in the damn ring. Then we cut backstage, and Steve Austin is seen at the bottom of a stairwell, unconscious, with Shawn Michaels there, along with a bunch of officials.
And a cinder block next to his head.
A damn cinder block. Remember that, folks. A cinder block to the head. Michael Cole is outside. The paramedics are working on Austin. He's unconscious. And Cole notes there was a cinder block near his head. When Hunter shows up looking confused, and Austin is taken away in the ambulance, and Michael Cole's opinion, his medical opinion, is that Austin was attacked by someone in the building. Detective Cole. What great facts he has laid out for us to decipher what has happened. Someone in this building has attacked this man. Shawn Michaels then comes out. Earlier on, he was decked out in like a shirt and a suit jacket. Well, he comes out in his suit jacket, but somewhere along the way, he has lost his shirt. So he's got a suit jacket with his bare chest, looking like the ultimate asshole. He comes out and blames Hunter for the attack and tells Hunter to bring that bony little ass of yours out.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hunter and his bony ass come out. Hunter has changed from his acid-washed jeans to his acid-washed jean shorts. That was his wardrobe.
He chopped them off. Good boy.
And denies doing this horrible act. And Michaels says that now you're going to have a Falls Count Anywhere match, and it's going to be a three-way tonight, but your number one contendership at SummerSlam is up for grabs. And Michaels will be the special referee. But Hunter says, Austin's out, so who's going to be in this three-way? And Michaels says it's going to be you, The Undertaker, and he did this long build to reveal that the third member of the match will be China. And Hunter laughs it off, saying, China is just a girl. And China grabs the mic and says, just a girl? Try me, Triple H. Try me. And Hunter is stunned that China, his woman, is going to fight him tonight.
Oh,
and we get the weirdest three-way match in history.
I would say in history.
God.
I've seen
Could you imagine China. If it had been like Stephanie involved in this match?
I don't know. I've seen plenty of three-ways with China, though, that were weirder than this.
Well, yes. Many Royal Rumbles she's been in, too.
Mm-hmm.
So Hunter and China, they're in this badly lit room after the break arguing. And then we get our big tag title match. The Acolytes against Kane and X-Pac for the tag titles. We have Kane's, like, opening to his music. And then it cuts to X-Pac's, the DX theme, to come out to, which X-Pac and Road Dogg had spent the summer fighting over the royalties to the DX name with Billy Gunn and China. And they had won the rights to the DX intellectual property.
Right, so DX right now were broken up, and the only members officially of DX were Road Dogg and X-Pac and possibly Kane. Is that it?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay, so Billy Gunn was out.
Billy Gunn was out, China was out, Hunter was out.
Okay.
So Ross notes that they are now together musically.
Mm-hmm.
They're also together with their pyro, which they would coordinate together.
Yeah.
This was a beautiful marriage. X-Kane. Kapok.
Yeah, sure.
Kapok.
Kapok, okay.
X-Zane. X-Zane. They could have gone all the way with these two. Cocaines. No, I don't know. So the Acolytes. The Acolytes were in this weird phase where the Ministry of Darkness was gone, the corporate ministry was gone, but they were still these weird characters with this shit on their chests before the APA. Thank God they came up with that APA act, because the Acolytes felt so out of place with this stupid gimmick.
It felt like a really awkward gimmick for these two people. I mean, at any time. You know, I think Farouk went from the Nation of Domination into this, and then I guess Bradshaw was what, in the West Texas Rednecks?
He was the new Blackjacks.
Oh, sorry, the new Blackjacks. And to go from that to... I guess all the Ministry of Darkness characters were pretty out of place for the people involved.
Midian, Viscera.
Yeah. But it was just weird how, you know, during this phase, they really had nothing else going on, so they still had to maintain the gimmick and the look, but nothing about the characters themselves and their promos had really anything to do with that.
So the match starts off with them getting heat on X-Pac, and Farouk hit a spinebuster. They just get the heat immediately. Bradshaw catches a spinning heel kick, drops X-Pac, bear hug, hits a big boot, and then finally X-Pac hits an enziguri to tag in Kane, who hits a top rope clothesline, stops a chokeslam attempt to Farouk, and then a double shoulder block drops both Acolytes. X-Pac comes in, he blocks the Dominator as Kane pulls Bradshaw to the floor. X-Pac hits the X-Factor and gets the win in what was a lengthy match by the standards of this show. 4 minutes and 36 seconds as X-Pac and Kane win the tag titles, and Road Dogg comes out to celebrate with them. The match was what it was. It was like...
Felt like an Iron Man match.
It was. I mean, these... I would imagine, like, this must have been very difficult for some of these guys to... I mean, even if you're regularly doing house shows, where it's like a traditional tag match where you're getting the heat and building up, and it's like, you got to condense that. I would imagine most guys, like a 3-minute match, damn near impossible to have a great 3-minute match.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying this was great, but these had to be extremely difficult to have to get this stuff across in such a... Like, Val Venus and Jarrett, you got a minute 25.
Well, I feel like there's definitely less importance put on the wrestlers to have great matches here on these shows.
Certainly.
These shows are certain, you know, they pretty much, again, like the Nitro from last week, they treated the wrestling pretty much secondary to the storylines and anything else going on these shows.
So the three of them are in the ring. Road Dogg's out to celebrate. And X-Pac is on the mic saying, if you aren't down with them as the new tag team champions, Kane has two words for you, and they've got the voice box.
Oh, I love the voice box.
But X-Pac takes the voice box and says, you don't need this anymore, and says those two words, and Kane says,
You don't need this damn thing anymore. Come on. Let's hear it without this thing. Come on!
I can't believe this. Kane's got two words for us! Kane speaking his first words, and they are memorable ones.
Socket.
This is the best part of the show.
Holy shit.
Highlight of the show. I remember watching this live, actually, or at the time, and I just recall it being really the first crack of the first time that they would kind of ignore portions of the Kane character mythos, you know, and he would kind of continuously go on to shed more and more pieces of it to the point where, you know, we get him today. But when the Kane character debuted, I mean, he was a guy who was burnt on his whole body and, you know, couldn't talk because his vocal cords were damaged, but... You know, all of a sudden you get things like this with no real explanation. Well, how come he can talk all of a sudden?
He's been training.
I suppose. He's getting speech therapy.
X-Pac has been channeling his inner promo skills and dispersing them towards Kane.
So, I thought the voice box was like this super creepy thing that was like kind of cool, but I suppose, you know, they felt it was limiting for this guy.
So, I mean, just a few months later, these two would be feuding after X-Pac stole his girlfriend and then would reveal that Kane was, like, impotent or something like that.
He had burnt balls.
Yes, yes, which didn't affect his vocal cords. So
he trained his balls.
Some real interesting anatomy lessons from the X-Pac Kane tag team and later feud. So there you go. I have new tag team champions crowned. And then The Undertaker and Big Show. Ross proclaims that Kane's first words are memorable ones.
Suck it.
Yeah. Suck it. The Undertaker and Big Show then run in and beat down all three. And then Big Show, adding to the problem, low blows Kane. So maybe the fire was not the cause. And it could have been Big Show.
Yeah.
So then we got, remember GTV? We got a GTV segment where Billy Gunn is with a massage therapist. And she's got these oriental herbs. And Billy asks for her to rub them on his ass. The woman then puts on latex gloves to rub this oriental herbs onto his ass, and then she proceeds to rub his ass.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yep. This is the Attitude Era, everybody.
Right. This GTV was like a precursor, I think, to TMZ.
Yeah?
Just like footage that would find its way into a major mainstream outlet.
Sure.
Joey Abs and Steve Blackman took on Test and Ken Shamrock. This was the most 1999 match ever. Shane McMahon comes out on commentary. And the storyline is that Test has been going through all the members of the Mean Street Posse, and it's down to Joey Abs in Test's road to Shane McMahon. Shamrock attacked Steve Blackman with a chain last week on Raw as they're feuding. And then Shane goes after Test on the floor as the match begins. Shamrock is sent into the steps. Test then recovers, hits a big boot to Joey Abs, a swinging neck breaker. Shane then distracts, allowing Joey Abs to get the brief advantage. If you miss Shane McMahon's commentary, his dialogue consisted of, "Oh, man! Oh, man! Oh, man!" This guy was just nails on a chalkboard bad. I don't care what you say about the current Raw commentary. Shane was terrible.
I think he was, though, purposefully trying to be obnoxious.
So. I thought he was always terrible, even when he was a babyface on Sunday Night Heat. There was a gut-wrench powerbomb to Joey Abs. Ken Shamrock is using a kendo stick and then blasts Shane McMahon, who's holding a chair. Pump handle slam is delivered to Joey Abs, and Test gets the win in 2.5 minutes. And then Test places Joey Abs' ankle into the chair, comes off the turnbuckle and stomps it, then continues to attack the ankle, and then does another stomp off the turnbuckle. We got it. His ankle was broken, and then he chases after Shane McMahon, as they would have a big hardcore match at SummerSlam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tess was, of course, still dating Stephanie at this time, and, I mean, a lot of focus given to this guy who I think had a great look, great moveset, but in-ring and on the mic, still noticeably very green.
What are you talking about? We're about to get to a legendary Test promo. Billy Gunn just storms into the back. He pulls his pants down. The guy's wearing a thong, and his ass has a rash all over it.
I don't know. How do you think they faked that rash?
Maybe they used legit oriental herbs. He's a method actor.
Yeah.
He needed an ass irritation.
Okay.
This was irritating.
Mm-hmm.
This was the guy that had won the King of the Ring and was in your second biggest match of the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
Like, it's just
King ass.
King ass. Then we got the JVC Kaboom of the Week, which featured Big Show chokeslamming The Rock on Sunday Night Heat. And then Michael Cole is with Test, who calls the Mean Street Posse butt sniffers. And as if to just add the exclamation point to my love of this promo, refers to Joey Abs as a biatch. And tell Shane to sleep tight, big brother. And Test, I've said this before, he reminds me he's got the face of the Shermanator from American Pie. Hmm. Just that annoying-looking face. Buck teeth. That was Test.
Okay.
Biatch.
Listen, Michael, all I ever asked for me and Stephanie to be left alone, but Shane and those three little butt sniffers didn't want to listen. So I took matters into my hands. Fat ass, peak ass, three broken ribs, one strained neck. Rodney, oh, Tess broke my arm with a chair, it hurts. Tough luck, buddy. And won't you go on the back? Ask that little biatch, Joey Abs, how he feels after what I just did to him. And you know what? That leaves nobody, Shane, except me and you. So sleep tight, Big Brother.
So this was the height of Andrew Martin's career. There was this summer of 99 into the fall, and then the wedding would go down, and so would his career. The best was Terry Taylor. Hey, everybody. And he interviews Steve Blackman, which was just Steve Blackman yelling at Terry Taylor as if Terry Taylor had become Ken Shamrock. And Steve just yells at Terry Taylor like he's yelling at Ken Shamrock.
Wow, impassioned comments from Test. I know, Steve Blackman, there's something you have to say.
You bet your ass there is. Shamrock, it's real simple. I'll step into your world, the Lion's Den, if you step into mine. And that is weapons all around the cage. And anyone bad enough to get one can use it. So, this way this thing's got to end, one way or another!
And challenges him, I challenge you, Ken Shamrock, to a Lion's Den match as long as it's surrounded by weapons. And this is going to end one way or another.
One way or another. Or another.
I rewound this. I watched this many, many times. This was the best interaction of two human beings on this entire show. How is Steve Blackman not more of a comedic character of nostalgia? Like, what a god-awful promo he was. But this, he just yells at Terry Taylor.
I think these two promos were probably here to kind of lower our expectations to set the scene for the next segment.
Oh, boy. I love this. I was just howling at Terry Taylor and Steve Blackman. So, yes, we had the low, and then we had The Rock come out. He calls out the Big Show, but then the countdown clock appears. And I like just the structuring of this. They hit you off the top of the show, never referenced it, but it was, you got the countdown, and you knew it was coming, but then it was a nice surprise that here in the middle of The Rock's promo, I mean, who better to debut this guy going toe-to-toe with on the microphone? There's 15 seconds counting down, the lights go out, you had this elaborate video where it looked like there was smoke coming out of the Titantron, like, very cool video. And then the name Jericho splashes across the Titantron, and this place goes just apeshit. And they go nuts. Jericho appears, and, man,
yeah,
1999 fashion. Chris Jericho wearing this silver jacket and black pleather pants. Could you say I'm a heel? Without any words.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut to a sign of a guy who was just so excited. It read Jericho, J-E-R-I-C-O. Fuck the H. Ugh. Jericho's here. And, I mean, it almost feels silly to run through this promo. I think this is one of the more well-remembered promos in history in the WWF. Everyone remembers it. It was a great introduction of Jericho, who just runs down the WWF and, you know, funny in hindsight when you hear them saying it was a once profitable company. It's now a cliche. It's boring. They're in desperate need of a knight in shining armor. He's here to save the WWF. Ratings are down. Buy rates are plummeting. Mainstream acceptance is non-existent. Of course, this all tongue-in-cheek at a time when this was all at its apex. And runs down the locker room and calls The Rock an idiot standing in the ring. Tried to get a Go Jericho Go chant over on night number one. And calls out all the amateurs in the locker room and does coin the Y2J name. And I guess just your thoughts on this promo. And Jericho, who has always said this was at a time when they didn't script all this stuff. And he came up with this promo the night before in a hotel room and just came out and established himself, I thought, right out of the gate.
Well, let me just say that, I mean, I think this introduction is obviously quite legendary in the WWF's history, in pro wrestling history, perhaps. But can you imagine them doing this if Jericho didn't have that awesome song? Could you imagine them doing this, but with, like, Steve Blackman's entrance music?
Da-na-na.
It definitely wouldn't have worked. So a big portion of the success of Chris Jericho's debut here is definitely this song, which I think is still one of the best.
Which they altered it slightly afterwards. I mean, this wasn't the first night. There were some alterations to it.
Yeah,
it was, from previous or for from future versions.
There's some lyrics changes, structural changes, but the basic song is still the same.
Oh, it was a superstar entrance.
It worked.
And he was positioned with another star, and I mean, it was joked afterwards the fact that this guy was more over in one segment than his entire WCW run.
Definitely. I think that's really interesting how much the confidence the WWF had in this guy who was, you know, pretty much a mid-carder, if not even, you know, just a cruiserweight for the longest time in WCW, to put him on a stage in his debut right with The Rock. The promo, and I think I've said this, you know, with most of Jericho's 1999 entrances or 2000s appearances on our podcast, I don't think it ages well. I feel like this is the same Chris Jericho kind of cocky, heel, obnoxious character that when you put him up next to The Rock, who's this kind of very overly confident, super established guy, it just I didn't see Jericho at all on the level of The Rock here. Of course it wasn't bad, but Jericho, you know, just kind of comes in, plays it very comedically, which I think is part of his appeal for sure, but I also wouldn't take him as seriously as I would a main eventer like The Rock or Stone Cold Steve Austin off the bat.
I like the promo, and I mean, we go back, and it's the nature of this show that we are going back and looking at stuff years in the past, and you do have to kind of assess this for what it was at the time, when I think a lot of The Rock's promos, that if you just watch them verbatim today, some of the stuff is really cheesy and corny, but I mean, completely clicked for the time that it was. And I think with this Jericho promo, I mean, I thought it was, you really established this guy, I thought, on the first night. Yes, they made it clear with The Rock's response. He runs down Jericho, plays up that he doesn't know who he is, and it was certainly The Rock was superior here at the end of it. They made it clear. He gets the last word. He runs down Jericho. But to me, it teased stuff for the future involving them, and I think it established Jericho as really an influx of talent when they very much needed it with guys of his level. And you can go through Jericho's book. I mean, his first year in the company, it was, you know, disaster seems like a too harsh a word, but he had a horrendous time when he came into the WWF, and this was a certain high point when he came in, but it would very much fizzle. And this was at a time when Hunter was establishing himself as the top heel, and then all of a sudden this guy comes in with a lot of momentum, and that would fizzle throughout 1999. What did you think of the idea of introducing him here? Certainly this was an awesome crowd to introduce him in front of. However, and this would really hit you over the head later at the end of the Big Show Rock match, you had so many moving parts. You had SummerSlam coming up. Jericho was not involved at SummerSlam. He wasn't going to be wrestling The Rock at SummerSlam. Did they do this too early? Like, would you have saved this for maybe the night after SummerSlam? Or, because there was so much going on with The Rock. He was feuding with Big Show. He was feuding with Billy Gunn. Now you're introducing Chris Jericho, and you introduced this guy to all this fanfare, but you didn't have a big direction for him, and his direction ended up not being The Rock. It ended up being a feud with Road Dogg after SummerSlam.
So what was the idea behind debuting him tonight?
I guess you had a huge, this is a big show in Chicago. Certainly there was, this is a bigger Raw than usual when you had Ventura on it. And I guess that was just their decision to have him show up at this. But his appearance at SummerSlam was to do commentary for a match. And then he spun off feuding with Road Dogg and then X-Pac. And you had this great debut, I thought, with The Rock, where you had him with a main eventer, but he was quickly slotted at a mid-card position. And it was a long time before he was really taken as that top guy. Even when just less than a year later, they did that tease of the title change with Hunter on that Raw. But it was an interesting time period to watch Chris Jericho, of where he went and how they presented him on night one. And it was anything but a smooth ride after, which is the case for a lot of guys we see. Like a Kevin Owens, for instance, who starts off huge, and then he goes through his peaks and valleys.
In hindsight, I mean, it really, nobody thinks about, oh, when they debuted Jericho, they just remember the moment. So, and it's not like The Rock had a really hot feud going on at this time. You know, he really had very little interaction with Billy Gunn at all. I mean, it just seemed like that match was a complete afterthought for The Rock. So, not that it made a big difference in the long run, but perhaps, you know, it would have made for a smoother transition if they did this a week after, perhaps. I don't know. But like, in hindsight, it doesn't matter.
Like, realistically, I think by August of 1999, they had largely given up on the Billy Gunn experiment, because the following month, he was placed back into the New Age Outlaws. If that wasn't a declaration that this guy is not going to cut it in the position we had envisioned for him in June, that was it. And I honestly believe that had you made that decision a month earlier and Jericho's debut match was going to be at SummerSlam against The Rock, I think they would have had, I think, a very good match at a time when good matches were kind of few and far between. I mean, great matches were extremely rare in this 1999 time period. And this was a great kickoff that you could have set up that match for SummerSlam, because I always look at the Billy Gunn run as just, it was just a mistake, as it kind of bared itself out. So anyway, that was the big debut of Chris Jericho. Hardcore Holly is in the back looking for the Big Show. He's calling himself the Big Shot at this point. They had a really well put together ad for SummerSlam, I thought, where they just showed all these shots of referees getting knocked out and attacked by wrestlers, and stating that that all ends with Jesse Ventura, who's not going to be knocked out. You're going to get a clean finish, and just plugging Jesse Ventura as the referee for SummerSlam. Big Boss Man against the Road Dogg. They note this is a hardcore rules match, but it is not for Big Boss Man's hardcore title. Road Dogg comes out. We saw a cookie sheet used. We saw a chair shot to the head, which I will note got absolutely zero reaction from this crowd. Mm-hmm. Then there was a powerbomb to Road Dogg through the table, but Al Snow shows up with a dog-carrying case, hits Big Boss Man, and allows Road Dogg to land on top of the Boss Man, who's out from this plastic casing.
We're supposed to believe that Pepper, Al Snow's dog, was actually in the case at the time.
Yes.
But we're supposed to believe that this man who loves his dog would use the dog in a cage to attack a man.
And, of course, Pepper was not inside, but you're led to believe he is. But of course, the WWF, they would not push anything like animal cruelty, which then after SummerSlam we would learn, oh, they absolutely would, as we would get the big build to Kennel from Hell the following month. So Road Dogg wins this match in all of a minute 13, and Lawler then clarifies to everyone, it's a non-title match, so it means nothing.
So, I mean,
co-sign.
I don't know if you caught it, John, but recently the WWE put out an online poll asking fans of all the defunct titles in their history which one they would like to see brought back. And it was, you know, the European, it was the Cruiserweight. The women's title was actually on the list, hardcore title as well. And the winner by a landslide was the hardcore title. Like, I'm talking like 50%.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, personally,
I would not be one of those people.
Me neither. And I don't know how, you know, necessarily the people listening to our podcast would necessarily feel the same way. But I think it shows that, at least amongst the casual fan base, there's still a lot of nostalgia for hardcore, for the 24/7 rule. A lot of nostalgia, but I wonder if those same people remember just how shitty these matches were week to week.
Yeah, I think that, you know, going with, you know, evidence like online polls, I would imagine that of all the people, hey, what kind of stipulation matches would you like to see the Divas compete in? And you went through various stipulation matches. I bet you a bra and panties match would probably win an online poll.
Absolutely.
However, if you were to actually execute that, I think a lot of people would just totally shit on it today.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people would be just... that was an era that it worked for a pocket of time, and then people got tired of it, and you did something that worked for a very small amount of time, and then you move on from it. And I look at those hardcore matches, I mean, I think a lot of people were burnt out by them at this point in 1999, mm-hmm. and it would still continue for a number of years afterwards. The Rock against The Big Show. And they're plugging Chef Boyardee as Big Show comes out, and Lawler notes that that's a big bowl of ravioli right there. Paul White compared to ravioli. The Rock hits our third side Russian leg sweep of the night. This was the suicide dive of 1999. There's a flying forearm from The Big Show, headbutt. Ross notes nothing finesse, nothing smooth about The Big Show. Big Show hit a sidewalk slam for a two count, and then Hardcore Holly comes out. He sends him off the apron. There's a low blow by The Rock to The Big Show behind the referee's back. He hits a DDT, and then he sets up for the People's Elbow, and the place comes unglued for the tease of the People's Elbow. But before he can hit it, Chris Jericho, totally forgotten that he made a second appearance on his debut night, runs in for what has to be one of the weakest stops to a match with this light shove to the lower back of The Rock as he's setting up for the People's Elbow, and the DQ is called at 3:36. Then Billy Gunn runs in to attack The Rock and lays him out. As he leaves the ring to go up the ramp, he does not forget to scratch his ass to sell the poison ivy. I can't make this shit up. And this was just, my mind was just in a million directions here of The Rock's programs. Like, it was just too much for me. I don't know what you were supposed to digest here. And to be honest, of like, of all the combinations you want to see, I would say Billy Gunn would be the last one here of these three.
Yeah, for sure. It just seemed like Jericho was kind of shoehorned into this whole thing. And I don't know what they're thinking of with Billy Gunn to build to this match with The Rock with this whole ass scratching storyline.
He was ass backwards.
Which was actually the shirt that he had.
Do you remember how that SummerSlam match culminated?
No.
There's a show that I really have no desire to go back and watch because I recall it being one of the worst SummerSlams ever. The culmination to your King of the Ring taking on your number two babyface was Billy Gunn bringing an oversized woman to be in his corner. And then when The Rock won the match, this woman, who I think had like some thong on, ended up giving like Billy Gunn's face got shoved into her ass. So the tables were turned and Billy Gunn was placed into a heavy woman's behind. That was the booking of the second biggest match of SummerSlam.
Cool.
Yeah, great. Jesse Ventura returns for the main event where he's going to do commentary with Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. Smart utilization of Jesse Ventura.
Yeah.
But also funny because, I mean, Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura, they were broadcast partners in WCW where the two left and they did not enjoy working with one another. And this was their first time working together since WCW. And there was like
this. What was the reason?
I don't know like all the specifics. It was just kind of a clash of two people. And I think that they left and it was just kind of the two just didn't get along. And then they'd work together on this night, and then they would be paired in the XFL as well years later. But it was so funny because there was like this like weird passive aggressiveness between Ross and Ventura. However, Ventura and Lawler, they were just like best friends, and Jesse's laughing with them, talking about their match in Memphis with the San Diego Chicken, and you couldn't have a more different interaction with Jesse and Lawler. So it was just rather fun.
How uncomfortable.
Shawn Michaels is out as our guest referee wearing his Shawn Michaels Wrestling School t-shirt, plugging the phone number on the back, which in the summer of 1999 is when Bryan Danielson would have been working there and training under him. He would have started just in June.
Wow.
So he did have a future star working under his school. And then China had already come out, and she's in the corner, and Shawn comes from behind and like pretends to like go grind China from behind. And China like has no idea what's going on and then turns around. And Shawn is wearing these just ridiculous tight shorts as well. Ventura doesn't dispute that Steve Austin has been hurt, But he is not going to blame anyone. He says Steve Austin drinks a lot, and he might have had one too many. Maybe that's what happened, and he caused a cinder block to fall on his head. This is the conspiracy theory guy, so he's not ruling out any conclusion. So the match begins. Bizarre match with Triple H, China, and The Undertaker, who just was... He just stuck out like a sore thumb in this match. He had no connection to this match at all.
The Undertaker?
Yeah. Mm. He just felt like he was a bit player here. The story was Hunter and China here, and you needed someone as like your transition guy. Hunter and Taker go at it. Taker strikes China as she falls from the turnbuckle to the floor. On the floor, Taker is put into the post after a knee lift from Hunter. Ventura says he will not be dressing like Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam because he is taking this seriously. Unlike the babyface commissioner. And says he is training, and he emphasizes how important the referee's job is. I thought Jesse did a pretty good job on this show of selling this main event. It's a serious deal.
Yeah. Didn't really feel like he lost much of a step here.
It was just funny that Jesse's selling this as this is to crown the best wrestler. This is a major match, and we would be going off the show thinking we're getting Austin against China as your main event. But China hits Hunter with a forearm and low blows him, and the crowd was into all of this. She takes a choke slam from the Undertaker. Hunter then hits a flying knee, sending Taker out, gets a two count on China, and then Austin is shown returning in the back, and he grabs a chair. The man has overcome a cinder block to his head within an hour. Unbelievable.
They recovered fast.
Top babyface Wolverine in the WWF. Hunter and China get sent to the floor, and Austin comes out. The place goes nuts. He blasts Hunter with a chair shot. And then, with China on the floor as well, he places China on top of Hunter, and China gets the pinfall because it's falls count anywhere as Taker watches dumbfounded from the ring. The match ends in 6 minutes and 48 seconds, and he looks pissed at Austin. And we go off the air with the idea that SummerSlam will be headlined by Steve Austin and China for the WWF title, and Jesse Ventura is our referee.
Mm.
Pretty ballsy at this point that this would be the idea, the match they would float until they would change everything up, and it would end up being Austin, Hunter, and Mankind, who was coming back from knee surgery.
Oh, wow.
So a very wacky change of events for SummerSlam.
Yeah, it definitely felt like there was a lot. Like, the show, I mean, if you guys haven't noticed, we're already like an hour and a half into this podcast.
I took more notes for this show than most 3-hour Raws.
A lot of stuff happened on these shows. They crammed a lot, and a lot of that was not taken up by wrestling time, I'll tell you that. The matches on the show, I think, as expected, were pretty weak. Nothing, you know, everything just to serve as a backdrop for the storyline, which was... which kind of range from largely kind of stunt-based, theatrical, gimmicky, to just stupid. So I think, you know...
Did this not get you pumped for SummerSlam?
Nope.
Well, then.
Not going to watch that. But, I we wanted to watch the show because of the Jericho debut, which I think... Production-wise, was just handled tremendously. I thought they did a fantastic job.
Well, there you go. That was Raw, which that particular night, they did... I mean, look at these numbers they were doing. They did a 6.4 that night. Monday Nitro did a 3.1.
Wow.
So they were handing WCW a beating in the summer of 1999, which from a popularity standpoint, I mean, the summer of 1999... was pretty damn big. They would have a bigger financial year in 2000, 2001, but in terms of just popularity on cable television, also remember at this point, you had essentially 3 hours of TV a week between Heat and Raw. That was it. SmackDown would not be debuting for a number of weeks, but that would be changing things a lot as well with the introduction of SmackDown.
When would they tape Heat at this time?
They would typically tape Heat... There were times they would do it live, and then others where they would tape it in conjunction with Raw tapings.
Before Raw?
They would tape it... I can't remember off the top. I think before Raw, yes.
Okay. That must be a little
because
weird.
Because this was still at the time where... God, I can't remember. They were still taping Raws occasionally.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They were not going live every week, but that would change shortly after this because they would have to with the SmackDown tapings on Tuesdays.
Right.
All right. So that will wrap things up. Next week, Mr. Ting, it is the big anniversary show. And we have thought long and hard about what would be a suitable review for next week. And I have put together this collage of clips building up to what was a monumental event in not just WCW history, not just in wrestling history, in history. It was the summer of 2000. We were all young. Most were stupid. And those people were booking WCW. So next week, we will review an event so big that it will be one of the largest reviews in Review Away history next week on this particular show. It's the 6th anniversary show.
All right, let's just get to it. Come on.
No, I'm doing the Shawn Michaels here, building and building and building as we get ready for our blood to boil next week, and it will rise in Canada.
What? In Canada?
The rumors are rampant that come August 13th at New Blood Rising on pay-per-view, there's a three-way dance. There apparently is some problem with who's going to come out on top in that match. And I guess the question is that going to be your final match if things really don't go your way?
Well, number one, things are going to go my way. I mean, no matter what this, you know, no matter how it's booked, laid out, argued, lobbied, I'm not going to lobby for a finish on this one. I'm just going to go out there. I bounced for 7 years before I got in this business, and I never got my ass kicked once.
Bill Goldberg believes in his own little mind that if this world were real, then he could take everybody. He can take everybody's ass.
And I don't see it happening. I'm bigger than both those guys. I'm definitely meaner than both those guys.
What can we expect at New Blood Rising, then?
I'm going to go over, because I said so. And I'm not going to cry about it like the rest of them. I'm going to go over. It's my time to go over. It's my time period. You know, I got 17 months left here. I was one of the few guys that I gave my blood for this place. It's time for me to get mine, and then I'll go off in the sunset, but I'm getting mine.
That comes up August 13th at New Blood Rising in the three-way dance. You're going over?
I'm going over. Like Brett, I'm going to do the Bret Hart. I guarantee I'm going to win.
We can't be on the air now. This is like Bizarro World Nitro.
The hotlines, the dirt sheets, full of rumors.
We go up in Vancouver. I can't guarantee I'm going to be professional.
WCW's Bash at the Beach shocked you. Sunday, August 13th, New Blood Rising will rock you to the core again. It's about real hatred, real power, incredible damage. Goldberg, Scott Steiner, and Kevin Nash will fight for a shot at the title. And after 8 years, your champion, Booker T, won the title. Now he'll do anything to keep it. You cannot imagine what will happen until you see it live. Order WCW's New Blood Rising Sunday, August 13th at 8 Eastern, live and only on pay-per-view.